Send your gifts by faith to Save America Ministries, P.O. Box 70879, Richmond, Virginia, 23255. Do it today. Become a partner with us. Pray for our kids. Let's do the kind of parenting that God would have us to do.
You've been listening to Viewpoint with Chuck Crismeyer. Viewpoint is supported by the faithful gifts of our listeners. Let me urge you to become a partner with Chuck as a voice to the church declaring vision for the nation. Join us again next time on Viewpoint as we confront the issues of America's heart and home.
The views expressed on this program are those of the hosts and guests and are not necessarily those of IRN, its advertisers, or affiliates.
Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests. And this evening we have with us Dave McGowan. He's written a book called Programmed to Kill, The Politics of Serial Murder. And I think it's only fitting that here on Friday, as we look back at what happened on Monday at Virginia Tech, then we have Mr. McGowan. He was scheduled long before the serial murders last Monday, but this is simply another example of these terrible things that have happened. But you see, there's so much that the American people don't know about. For instance, there was so much that had happened at Columbine and the shooting in Columbine in Colorado. And they sealed so many of the records so that the public could never know. Now, why would you bother to seal the records of what happened at Columbine? Why wouldn't everybody want to know? Didn't they have the right to know? And didn't the families have the right to know? Were we trying to keep the information from Keybold and Harris? Or are we trying to keep the information from the American people? In a similar manner, the testimony of some 1,100 people who testified before the 911 Commission about what really happened on September 11, 2001 was sealed, really because, of course, we couldn't let Osama bin Laden know what happened that day. To seal in the name of national security, we always have to seal the information from the public. And so often, what happens as far as the serial crimes are concealed, the FBI has a division. Their job is to go around trying to convince people all across America and police forces there is no such thing as satanic ritual crime. It just doesn't exist. The Central Intelligence Agency employs people like Dr. Jocelyn West, formed an organization called the False Memory Organization. Its purpose was to go around to teach people that there was false memories. A lot of people thought they'd been satanically ritually abused, but if it was only was a false memory, it was the imagination. Why did the CIA was involved in trying to convince the general public that all these allegations, so many of them, of satanic ritual abuse of children was simply a false memory concocted by a psychiatrist? Or, well, there's so much that we're not being told. And with that as a background, David, thank you very much for being with us this evening.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
What was your impression as you heard the story of what had happened there at Virginia Tech?
Hauntingly familiar.
Like deja vu all over again.
Yeah, right? It seemed to follow the same script. I mean, you know, there's, you know, it's these things play out in a very scripted, choreographed kind of way, and this one definitely, it definitely fit the mold.
Yeah, well, of course, you have to understand what Dave's story is. I mean, I've read a lot of these things. I don't like reading about all of these things. I don't even like to think about them, but for some reason, God's put me in a position of talking about it and trying to get people to understand that there are powerful spiritual forces at work in our society, and they are organized evil. And this is not imaginary, it's very real. But I will tell you that David's book never really even touched me. I mean, there's such a volume of material. So I'm going to let him go ahead in just a moment, start telling us what motivated him to write this book. Compile, I mean, this is an encyclopedia of what you really need to know to understand the true nature of the battle in which we're engaged today. I mean, which has brought our troops into battle in Afghanistan and Iraq and probably very soon in Iran and heaven only knows where. We'll be right back. Well, David, you picked this story up, and what motivated you to write this? How did you get interested in this story?
Okay, it actually grew out of a little tidbit of information that I picked up while researching my previous book that had come out before that one. And in researching that one, I just happened to stumble across the fact that George Bush, while as governor of Texas, had issued, despite the popular misconception that he didn't grant leniency to any of the capital cases that came before his death. That's almost true, but there was one exception, and that one exception was Henry Lee Lucas.
Henry Lee Lucas. Well, tell our listeners who Henry Lee Lucas was, because most of them are really unacquainted with that incredible story.
Henry Lee, it was one of the most prolific of America's quote-unquote serial killers, based primarily in Texas, although he traveled throughout several states, and he claimed at one time he confessed to as many as 600 murders.
600 murders, in
and people, you know, a lot of people have said that those numbers were inflated, that he was just used by police departments all across the country to clear up, you know, problematic unsolved homicides, that he took credit for all of these different crimes all across the country that he didn't actually commit. And there's probably some truth to that, but by all accounts, the guy was responsible for a staggering number of murders that included, you know, all the usual elements of serial murder, torture, mutilation, rape, cannibalism, necrophilia, you know, any kind of depraved, you know, serial killer type behavior you could dream of. This guy had perpetrated and confessed to and admitted it, and yet he was the one guy out of all the cases that came before George Bush, out of, I think, 140-some cases that came across his desk as governor, he was the only one that got his sentence commuted.
He had been sentenced to death, and the man who today is president, who's sending our boys over to fight and bleed and suffer and die but never win in Iraq, has commuted the sentence on this man who had admitted to committing hundreds of murders.
Yeah, so I included that in my second book as just sort of an example of these kind of stories that the media just completely ignores. I mean, you will find like virtually no mention of that in any media accounts. It was just, you know, this very odd thing that happened that was never reported.
Hold that thought just a moment,
okay,
there, please. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is David McCowan. His book is Programmed to Kill. And Dave's written several books, and I asked him why he had written this one. And he said, well, in a previous book, he had actually come across the fact that Henry Lee Lucas, certainly the world's greatest confessed serial killer, had confessed to over 600 murders, rape. I mean, I will not go into the horrible things that were done to the victims, but he confessed to them all. And he was condemned to death in Texas, And yet in Texas, of course, they had executed a fair number of people. In fact, I think George Bush had been there. They'd executed 100-some-odd people. And the one person whose sentence the president actually had exonerated, given him off so he couldn't be executed, was Henry Lee Lucas, who had admitted, confessed to killing over 600 people. So go ahead and pick this story up. That must have raised some question in your mind. Why
did
the president
commit
that sentence and let all the others go to death? Maybe many who even professed they were innocent. Henry Lee Lucas admitted killing 600 people. The greatest.
Yeah, so I started getting a lot of questions from, you know, people would write to me, email me, that had read the first book and say, you know, well, do you have any theories about why? Why would he have done that? Why would he have, you know, why would this have been the only time that he exercised his legendary compassionate conservatism, you know? So I started looking into it, and in looking into it, I discovered that he had written a book, or co-written, somebody ghost wrote it for him because he was largely illiterate. And within his book, what he revealed was that while it looked like he was just sort of this lone psycho serial killer, he was actually doing contract hits on behalf of a cult that had trained him down in the Florida Everglades. He had gone to like a paramilitary training camp. This is all in his own words. And been trained basically as a killer for this cult. And while he was out, you know, slaughtering these people and making it look like they were just sort of randomly selected victims of a psychotic killer, they were actually, a lot of them were actually contract hits that were deliberately disguised to look like a, you know, a random act of violence. And about that same time, someone tipped me off to a book by Maury Terry that you're probably familiar with, The Ultimate Evil.
Right.
A re-examination of the Son of Sam case, and basically he came to the same conclusion that David Berkowitz was acting on behalf of a cult of individuals, you know, a whole group of individuals, that he was just the fall guy, and that some of these killings were specific contract hits. And then as I looked further, I found a couple of cases in Europe. I think one in France, the Monster of Florence case, and I believe the other was like in Italy, which had recently been reopened because the evidence in those cases suggested that the supposed lone perpetrator that had been convicted was actually a fall guy for many more powerful individuals, you know, that were actually behind this. So at that point, I realized that this wasn't just you know, an exception, that this was, you know, there had to be something going on here, that all these different cases were being reexamined sort of and looked at in that way. So I dove head first into the stories of, you know, pretty much all of America's big name serial killers over the last, you know, several decades, and several of the minor ones. And what I found consistently time and time again is that these same themes kind of play out in the background of all of these, you know, if you look beyond the official story, which is always pretty much the same, sort of this, you know, this quote-unquote profile that it's a product of the FBI's Behavioral Sciences Unit, which basically coined the term serial killer to begin with and sort of invented this whole concept of the serial killer. But if you look beyond that public presentation at the details of these cases, you'll find that time and time again, there's something much, much different going on than what we were being told.
And, of course, the thing is that I think the significant thing about the story of the Son of Sam was it was very obvious, in fact, David Berkowitz, the Son of Sam, admitted, you know, that he was part of a satanic cult. And yet, of course, the law enforcement, at least the large part of the law enforcement in New York City, refused to investigate and try to find out who the other members of this satanic cult were. And that seems to be a recurrent theme as you go down through all of these things, both here and in Europe. I mean, because this is really worldwide. In fact, some of your descriptions of what's gone on in Europe are, just totally unbelievable. But then so many of the things going on in America are unbelievable, because we're never hearing about them through regular channels. If we do, we only hear about them once or twice, and then they're never mentioned again.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the truth is always buried. I mean, I was listening to your introduction when you were talking about them stealing the evidence from Littleton, and Littleton's actually not in the book. I did not go into the so-called spree killers, the school and workplace shooters, because the book was already growing so large as it was. That I
well, that'll give you we need to get to the truth of what really happened in Columbine.
Oh, absolutely. I have covered that, though, on my website. And what I was going to say was I was actually watching the news. I don't remember one of the cable news networks. I don't remember which one. The live coverage and the initial stories coming out of Virginia earlier this week, and they had on an audio feed one of the parents from Columbine, from Littleton, and they started asking him some questions, and the guy kind of went off on a rant about how they've been lied to for 8 years and stonewalled, and all the evidence has been covered up.
Why in heaven's name, how could they justify covering up the evidence and sealing the evidence and destroying the evidence?
Yeah,
they wanted to destroy it all at Columbine. Who were they covering for? And I'm sure that you know that there were all sorts of special programs there, special government programs, that I believe are very well linked to exactly what happened.
Yeah, well, according to the initial reports, if you look back over the initial reports before the official story, the official spin set in, there were reports that there were as many as 8 gunmen there that day. A lot of the students described, many, many more gunmen than just Harris and
Klebold, right?
Klebold. I mean, that was a pretty much of a paramilitary operation, and I mean, and just logistically, there's just no way that 2 kids could have carted all of those explosives and weapons and stuff into the school and planted them and whatnot, unnoticed. It's just the whole story. Just if you look at the initial reports that first came out in the couple of local papers there in Denver are the details as originally reported have no relationship to the story that we were eventually sold. And so this guy was ranting about that, and he was saying that some judge had just sealed some additional evidence for 25 more years. They were going to have to wait 25 more years to find out. And basically, he started to say that to the parents of all of the victims in Virginia, watch out, because you're going to be lied to, and they're going to cover up evidence. And next thing you know, the guy got cut off, and the anchor was saying, mumbled something about, oh, we appear to have lost the audio there.
they quickly
moved on to somebody else, because this guest was obviously not spouting the line that they had, thought he would when they lined him up, hastily lined him up to comment on, this unfolding tragedy.
Okay, so I heard somebody say, this is an unbelievable feat. I mean, here this man may have been armed, but to be able to actually, apparently the 9mm is not that effective a killing tool. And yet he was able to kill, 31 students with it, and I don't know, wound how many others. And I mean, incredibly accurate marksmanship, incredibly skilled. It's almost unbelievable.
Yeah, I mean, it's
these are trained people. People are trained with weapons. You're saying, we can't figure out how he could possibly have done that.
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty extraordinary. And the ratio of dead to wounded, I mean, normally, you would expect to have far more wounded than that. But, I mean, this guy was obviously shooting to kill, because, I mean, an extraordinarily high percentage of the people that were shot were dead, died or are in, critical condition.
Yeah, because nobody's ever asked where you go out and buy a flak jacket. I don't think you can just go out and buy a flak jacket, down to your local Macy's, can you?
I don't think so.
I mean, this story is so full of holes, you know. I mean, here he kills a couple of people, and then he goes home, and then he gets all of these things together and takes them to the post office. What are the police doing all this time? Oh, they think he's left the campus, left the state. They're not mobilizing things. They don't have an emergency there. They don't have police all over the campus.
Yeah, I know. They were just spinning like crazy on the news conferences. Well, you know, we were convinced that he'd not only left the campus, he had left the state.
Right,
you
right.
Know? Like, how could you possibly know that in that short time frame, you know?
Well, that of course justifies them not having police all over that campus, swarming the campus with police.
Yeah, which makes no sense to me at all, because, I mean, I live in Los Angeles where, I mean, anything these days brings, like, such an incredibly overwhelming police response, and it's just inconceivable that a multiple murder on a college campus wouldn't have just had that campus just swarming with, well, I mean, just, you know, every officer from every department, you know, in the vicinity would normally have been just swarming all over that place, and yet 2 hours later this guy was able to, you know.
Well, hold that thought. Well, Dave, go ahead and you tell your story here. So let's get, you know, you've actually beginning to see a pattern, you know, with this.
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Most Americans are iodine deficient today because they stopped adding iodine to our milk and to our flour, and only about half of the salt that's consumed in the United States today contains iodine. So Radio Liberty has produced a 4-tape or a 4-CD set that discusses the health benefits of iodine. We also offer iodorol. It contains 12.5 milligrams of iodine per tablet. And we also offer potassium iodide tablets that'll protect your thyroid gland in case there's a nuclear attack. So if you'd like to order these products or obtain additional information, why don't you call 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Or go to our website at RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. Once again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927.
You got headaches? Most headaches are caused by a structural weakness of blood vessels in the head, and the blood vessels are tending to balloon, causing a headache. The structural weakness is due to a deficiency. Correct the deficiency and the body will heal itself. I blended what I believed to be the missing nutrients in the right proportions, and the headaches went away. When they were gone, they stayed gone. I named it Headache Stay Gone. See HeadacheStayGone.com or call 800-327-0727 for more information or to place an order. I'll send you a bottle of Headache Stay Gone. Headache Stay Gone will cure your headaches and prevent them from coming back before you pay the bill. Headache Stay Gone has already cured the worst migraines I have ever heard of. Call 800-327-0727. All orders are shipped the same day. Call 800-327-0727. That's 800-327-0727.
Hi, this is Dr. Tony Tierry. Are you one of the many people who take vitamin supplements? Do you take handfuls of pills each day to increase energy, reduce your pain, or improve your overall health? Now there is a better way to get the vitamins and minerals your body needs in a delicious-tasting whole food liquid supplement, Body Balance. Body Balance contains 121 essential vitamins and minerals and is made from only organic and natural sources. Developed by doctors, Body Balance was originally available only through healthcare professionals. Now this incredible whole food liquid supplement can be delivered directly to your home. Body Balance offers an extremely effective method to feed your body towards wellness, and we're confident you'll love the difference your body feels. To order your Body Balance, call me directly at 1-800-768-9763 and try it risk-free for 45 days. Again, that's 1-800-768-9763 or online at healthyfoundations.net.
He's convicted and sent to jail, immediately out of jail, and he gets involved with something else again, and he's sent to jail for a long time, and immediately out of jail, almost as if there's an invisible force behind him, and then finally, of course, they pick him up, and he's got these girls in chains down in the basement of his home, and then as his story unfolds, White gets into the King of Belgium. The ministers, the police, the officials, the people from the, although it isn't mentioned in the book, it ties into the Bilderbergers, it ties into the elite of Europe. And then we find out that there's similar organizations in Latvia and in Great Britain and in France and in Italy. And by the time you finish reading the first chapter, and you're talking the highest officials in Portugal, right into the very echelons of the Catholic Church, all of this pornography and really some of this is basically Satanism and human sacrifice at every level of upper society, and always covered up by the government and often covered up by the media, although you get glimpses of it in the media, and there have been enough articles that David was able to track down. So there's no question that these things are real. So you pick the story up, David.
This is a worldwide, very much a worldwide problem, and it's not just it's not just perpetrated here, and it's not just covered up here. I discovered cases, as you said, that surfaced, over the last 10 years or so in Latvia, in Portugal, I don't even remember all, but quite a few countries, and inevitably these rings lead directly to key entertainment figures, key political figures, key police, and law enforcement figures, which is why they're able to cover it up as effectively as they are, because they've got assets, so to speak, in law enforcement, in the courts, in the media, and. And you find this time and time again, and frequently there are, as you say, cult overtones to a lot of this. And when we talk about child pornography, this isn't just like somebody posting a picture of their kid in the bathtub. We're talking about this is brutal, sadistic stuff that includes film torture and even death in some cases. And all of the references I use, by the way, in case anyone's questioning this, and it took a lot of digging, but all of the references that are used in the first section of the book that covers all this kind of stuff are all drawn from mainstream media sources, what most average Joe would consider credible media sources, mostly in throughout the English-speaking world, from Australia, New Zealand, England, Scotland, Ireland, various places that I uncovered all these stories. But it has been reported, if you dig long enough and fit all the little bits and pieces together, it has been credibly reported in the respectable media that this stuff is going on, and that it includes actual child snuff films that are being traded basically by these rings, over via the internet, and every once in a while one of the cases will break, and there'll be a flurry of news stories about it, but nothing ever seems to become, once the trail starts leading in the wrong direction, all of a sudden the whole thing gets swept under the rug.
I'll never forget when there's a very famous case here in California, Polly Klass. The fellow who killed Polly Klass had been arrested 35 times for this sort of thing, for molestation and violating a little girl's 35 times. And then, of course, the 36th time, why, of course, we know what happened to Polly Klass. But how many other times had he killed and gotten away with it? But why would you let somebody off 35 times?
Yeah, well, yeah, that's another common theme that I found throughout a lot of these cases, both in the realm of the child pornography and in the serial killers, is this extraordinary lenient treatment of these people. You know, up until the time when they're finally captured amid a big media circus. It's extraordinary how many times these people manage to just, like Ted Bundy basically just walked out of jail on two separate occasions, when he was incarcerated for, facing murder charges.
Hold that thought, we're going to be back here in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here. Our guest is Dave McGowan, and Dave is giving us the background of what he's found as he's researched these cases. And here's Ted Bundy, who is certainly another, I don't know how many people he admitted to killing, but, how was he able to get out of prison a couple of times, facing murder charges? It's almost as if there's an invisible force behind these people, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, there's you definitely get the impression, after you read these things over and over again about how these people were given extraordinarily lenient treatment, or how they managed to, make these improbable escapes, or in one way or another just sort of, managed to remain operating long past when they should have. It's hard not to come to the conclusion that they're basically operating under official protection. One of the most bizarre ones was Jeffrey Dahmer, who the police actually stopped him on the street with one of his victims and escorted them back to the apartment. Noticed nothing wrong, supposedly, in this guy's apartment, even though the place was, plastered with body parts and Polaroid pictures and all this other stuff, yet they noticed nothing wrong, supposedly, left this guy there with Dahmer, this underage kid who was drugged, naked, and bleeding, and left him there and wandered off, and Dahmer proceeded to complete what he had already started. That was one of the most extraordinary ones, examples of how these, people seem to, how the police, the various big city police departments just seem to manage to turn a blind eye to what's going on for an extraordinary amount of time.
Well, of course, you do recognize that there's some sort of a spiritual element to this that's either blinding these people or they're part and parcel of this. I mean, this really is organized evil, isn't it?
I believe so. Yeah, I mean, yeah, on a level that's almost impossible to comprehend how so much of this could be going on and be kept covered up for so long. There's obviously a lot of very powerful people that are right in the thick of it. There's really no other rational explanation,
No, well, of course, it took me a long, long time. I'm a little slow, learning. I'm 78. It took me a long time to realize there really is organized evil in the world. There really are people who would rather do evil than good. We'll be right back here with Dave McGowan. Well, Dave, I want you to go ahead with this story. Of course, first of all, do you have a website, anything you'd like to get out to our listeners?
Yeah, I do, actually. It's www.davesweb.cnchost.com. www.thehostanks.com. Kind of a lengthy URL, but yeah, and you'll find all kinds of different stuff on there. There's, at the top of the page is my 911 stuff. I am a charter member of the 911 Skeptics Club from day one, pretty much. There's various other things. There's a series of articles on the DC Sniper, and there's some stuff on Columbine, and just a variety, a wide mix of stuff you can find there. And
what do you think about the DC Sniper? Was that certainly this is some sort of a programmed killing? I mean, there's something more to the story than we've gotten. What's your take on it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it was very much so. And I mean, it was almost kind of too obvious at one point, where it seemed like the that one police chief guy, and I can't remember his name now. He was kind of a big media star for a while there, but he went on live on the air and delivered what sounded very much like a post-hypnotic suggestion, something about the ducks caught in a noose or something.
Right, right.
It was this really weird incident where he goes on and reads this nonsensical phrase, and then see, like, within hours, the pair are caught sleeping in their car, you know, offering no resistance. It was just, yeah, I mean, that was just one odd element of that whole case. I got a multi-part series on my website. A little sketchy on the details now because it's been a while, but yeah, I believe that whole thing was definitely choreographed.
And I think so many of these things are choreographed, but of course the question is, are they just coincidental? You know, for instance, Ed Kemper, you have a section on Ed Kemper. He was a mass murderer in our area. I took care of him. He was my patient. My wife knew him when she was the chief of surgical nurse on the surgical floor. He was the nicest kid. And yet, of course, he was a serial murderer. He killed his grandmother and grandfather and killed his mother and her best friend and was a cannibal. And I don't know how many young girls he killed. But, I mean, what in heaven's name? Of course, he was incarcerated for a while. He was in a prison. Do you think it was a program to kill or what?
I believe so. Yeah, and I mean, these people frequently, you know, for the most part, they present themselves as normal, you know, normal decent human beings. Sometimes even, you know, charismatic, you know, very popular people, and they're generally labeled. You know, they're generally slapped with the label of sociopath, and it's claimed that, you know, the image that they present to the public, their public persona, is just a fabrication, something that they've just made up to, you know, to gain social acceptance, to hide the monster within. But I don't necessarily believe that's true. I think most of these people, if not all of them, are true multiple personalities, and that the persona, their public persona that they present, is a legitimate, you know, is a very real personality, and the, you know, the one that kills is a separate personality, and you know, that's basically all tied into the whole, you know, the whole mind, concept of mind control, which is based on the concept of multiple personality, and you know, the basic principle behind you know, creating a mind control killer or you know, mind control slave or whatever, what have you, is basically through applying trauma to create multiple personalities, and then taking one of those multiples that are created and nurturing it to, you know, create this to create whatever it is you want to create out of that personality. And I believe that pretty much applies to a lot of probably virtually all of the people that we label as serial killers, and which is why they're able to, you know, to get through life and, you know, appear to be perfectly normal, because in their normal waking personality they are normal, but they've got another hidden personality that's being controlled, you know, oftentimes controlled, you know, beyond their control, maybe beyond their awareness.
Well, are you? Have you ever read Colin Ross's book? It used to be called Bluebird. It's now called CIA Doctors.
I've heard a lot about it, but I've read a lot of other books by various other people along the same sort of theme, but no, I have not read his.
Well, could you sort of get into that for our listeners? Because I think they have to understand these macabre experiments that have been done, you know, with our tax money to find it, to be able to produce these dissociated personalities. Because you really talk a lot about that. I think it's an important body of message.
Yeah, that's another thing that, I mean, there's a lot of elements in this book that it's hard for people to wrap their heads around. You know, one of them is the satanic cult and the occult crime sort of thing, and the other is the whole notion of mind control, which I very much believe is a tool that has been perfected long ago, and it is fairly commonly used. And like I say, that's kind of one of the main thing that's at play in a lot of these really horrendous child abuse, child pornography, and child prostitution rings that we were talking about earlier is what they're doing besides making money off of the exploitation of children. What they're doing is creating in these kids the potential of being future mind control victims by inflicting just this massive trauma on these kids. And what the basic human reaction when you're faced with an unbearable situation is, anyone that's had a beginning psychology class knows, it's the fight or flight reaction. But for a kid doesn't really have either one of those options. A kid, you can't fight back against adults, and there's nowhere to run. So what happens is that the human mind sort of adapts and does the best that it can to allow you to flee that situation by basically allowing you to mentally flee from that situation. And that's how multiple personality syndrome, which I believe is a very real phenomenon, that's basically how it's created, is through severe childhood trauma to the point where the kid is, as a defense mechanism, creates an alter personality, one or more alter personalities that they can then employ to use to deal with these recurring instances of just horrendous abuse. And so that's all part of the same, it's all part of the same program, basically. The traumatization of children that's visible in these videos that are just traded by these rings. It's not just about the sick pleasure of child pornography and child prostitution, although that is an element. There's also the element that these kids are basically being conditioned to where they can later be used. They will become the next generation of serial killers or whatnot, basically.
And of course, it's a terrible thing to contemplate. And there seems to be two parts of it. One of it is satanic ritual abuse, and I've actually talked to at least one person who's quite close to our family, who came from a family of Satanists, and they started abusing her when she was about 3 years old, and of course. Just a terrible, terrible story, and she eventually, of course, broke with him, and she's eventually been able to overcome most of this, although I'm sure the emotional scars will be with her the rest of her life. But then, of course, a lot of this then begins to intertwine with some of the things the intelligence agencies are doing as well. What about part does the CIA play in some of these programs? Or at least some of our other intelligence agencies, maybe we don't even know about them.
I believe they play a huge role, and as you were saying earlier, that there's no question but that the CIA and other intelligence agencies have been researching these methods of mind control for decades. Just with what has come forth through Freedom of Information Act requests to get the the documents from these programs, which are generally referred to as MKUltra, MKUltra program, although that was actually just one of the code names. There were many, many code names that were used for these programs, but they're generally just referred to, you know, sort of generically as MKUltra experiments. And there's no question whatsoever, you know, although a lot of people find it hard to believe, it is very well documented that the CIA and other intelligence agencies, you know, poured, you know, who knows how much money and brain power into researching and refining these very same techniques. So, you know, there's definitely a connection there. They have been deeply involved in this stuff, and much more deeply involved than what has been revealed through, you know, the information that has, but just based on what has come forth, we know that they were doing experiments with children, you know, I mean, drugging young children with LSD for like weeks on end, and just, you know, I mean, just, these are just the things that have been acknowledged. So you can only imagine how horrific, you know, some of the stuff is that they're not willing to admit to. So yeah, I believe that a lot of the satanic cults are basically used as covers, as sort of front groups by the intelligence agencies, and some of the larger, more organized ones have direct roots in various intelligence agencies. You know, the OTO was. And
could you explain to our listeners what the OTO was and what was its tie into the intelligence agencies?
The OTO, the Ordo Templi Orientis, began, I believe, in Germany. It was started by some German intelligence agents back in, I think around like the turn of the century or something. And gained from there. It was eventually taken over kind of by Aleister Crowley, a very infamous British occultist who was also
an intelligence agent,
exactly. And then it was passed on from there to like Jack Parsons and L. Ron Hubbard, who are both have intelligence pedigrees. And I mean, if you follow the line of succession, you find intelligence operatives all over the place.
Yeah, because L. Ron Hubbard is the father of Scientology.
Yeah, exactly.
And some of our leading Hollywood actors are Scientologists.
Yeah, exactly. Then the Church of Scientology vehemently denies that it sprung from occult roots, but it very clearly did. I mean, Hubbard was an associate of Jack Parsons in the Agape Lodge of the OTO in Pasadena.
Oh, wait, wasn't he also tied into Anton LaVey in some ways?
I know that his literary agent, Forrest Ackerman, was a member of Anton LaVey's Church of Satan. If you look, all of these groups kind of spring from each other. You know, I mean, the OTO basically. The Scientology basically sprang from the OTO, and from Scientology then sprang the process, the Church of the Final Judgment, which has been linked to, you know, the Manson killings and the Son of Sam killings and the Cotton Club murder of producer Roy Radin and various other nefarious crimes, and then from that sprang, you know, yet another. So, I mean, these groups, they just form these offshoots, you know. But if you trace back through these, you find that they're all kind of come from the same place, and that place is basically a rat's nest of intelligence operatives.
I think this is really what people have to understand. Is that some of the money we put in for our intelligence, you know, supposedly to guard us from the wicked communists, is spent on mind control. In fact, a lot of the Nazi scientists after the Second World War were brought over here under Operation Paperclip to carry on the macabre experiments here in the United States. Those that, of course, we didn't help to escape to South America and the rat line. But Operation Paperclip is something that people need to look into. Well, anyway, of course, it's fascinating as you begin to try to see the connection between all of this. But, of course, the one common denominator, it is truly organized evil. Would you agree or disagree with that?
Yeah, well, I mean, absolutely, it's organized, and it's definitely evil, so... But yeah, it's clearly organized. These aren't, you know, this is all, yeah, it's very organized and very much controlled from the top levels of government, I believe.
That, of course, one of the things, you have a quotation in here from Mark Dutrome, who has just said that he wasn't really in charge of this. He was simply an agent of people who were very, very powerful. You've got some wonderful, wonderful quotations from these people.
Yeah, well, a lot of people have raised questions about, and there's been a whole trail of dead bodies surrounding that case. You know, every time somebody's identified as a potential witness, next thing you know, they turn up dead, which is, you know, kind of another common element that you'll find in a lot of these stories, is that there's always a long trail of bodies, you know.
There are usually suicide. This one quotation from Mark Dutrome, he was the fellow over in Belgium who was really, of course, involved. Really, I don't know how many. Do we have any idea how many people he was responsible for killing?
I don't know what the final. I know that there was. They dug up several bodies from under his homes. And there were many other girls that disappeared that no one ever really found out what their fate was. There was, you know, talk that they had been basically sold, you know, sold off to people for whatever purposes, you know.
Let me just give the quotation here. People want to believe that I am the center of everything. They're mistaken. I did things of which I was not the driving force. I was used as an instrument by others. Who were themselves used as instruments by others. That is a fascinating a quotation.
And undoubtedly quite true, yeah.
Hold that thought. We're going to be back here in just a moment to wrap up the first hour here at Radio Liberty. Well, we're going to just have 3 minutes for you to wrap up this first hour. And, of course, it's been a fascinating hour. Our guest, of course, is Dave McGowan, his book, Programmed to Kill. And we're going to carry the book because I think it certainly is all-encompassing as anything I've seen on this subject. And hopefully we get people to understand really what we're up against today. So, Dave, why don't you just go ahead? You've got about 2.5 minutes here in this segment.
Okay, where do I start?
This is your field, top line.
Okay, one interesting fact that I discovered in looking at all these cases is that in virtually all of the serial killer cases that I looked at, the victims were dispatched in one of two ways, either with a small caliber handgun, fired, you know, a contact wound to the head, execution style, or they were killed with weapons of opportunity, which means a weapon, you know, anything that can be improvised as a weapon at the scene, something that's taken from the scene and used there. And what I found in looking through these is that both of those methods are methods that have traditionally been taught to professional assassins by, among other people, the CIA. In fact, in one of the CIA's assassination training manuals, which I included an excerpt of from like the 1950s, it specifically instructs would-be assassins to use weapons of opportunity, to not carry any weapons onto or off of the scene, but to improvise with what's there, you know, a knife or something that can be used for strangulation or whatever. And so I found it very, very fascinating that virtually all of these killings that, you know, that are supposedly done by these lone nuts that have no connection to one another or anything, they all use either one of those two methods, either a small caliber handgun, you know, shot to the head, contact wound to the head, or they use weapons of opportunity, both of which are traditionally methods that are taught to professional assassins, not to, you know, lone psycho nuts running around on the street. So I found that to be a very kind of a telling detail of these cases that no one had ever really looked at from that angle before.
The other thing I thought was so fascinating is how these are so often covered up by government, high government officials, and of course how many of the these things are never fully investigated, as if there's a force there that doesn't want the truth to come out. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is just this first hour has been David McGowan. He's going to be staying with us the second hour. His book is Programmed to Kill, and we're actually going to be carrying the book. I think it's an important book, and it certainly goes along with some of the other things. The message that, of course, we really have is that there really is an invisible force in society. It's been around for 5,000 years, and that's the subject of my latest talk. It's called Forbidden Secret. And really, if you want to understand and begin to be able to put things together as to what's really going on in the world today, and why we're engaged in war in the Middle East, and war after war after war, and why all the terrible things are happening, and why the very fabric of our society is crumbling, and why they've taken God and prayer out of our schools. And well, let me suggest the talk on Forbidden Secret. It's available in video, it's available in DVD, and will give you the common denominator. It will tell you the secret that has been passed down for 5,000 years through secret societies, never revealed, for fear that if it were ever revealed, it would lead to terrible consequences. Well, of course, this goes then along very well with Chris Pinto's excellent DVDs. There's two of them, and I happen to appear in both of them, a very small part, you know, sort of like a walk-on and then walk off quickly. But one is The Secret Mysteries of America's Beginning, an award-winning, a DVD, got the best documentary of the year last year from the New York Film Festival and several other awards. And then, of course, the latest one, which has not had a chance to win an award because it's only been out for a few weeks. But that's Riddles in Stone, The Secret Architecture of Our Nation's Capital. And we actually have a book by that title by Mr. Overson, but this, of course, is built upon that book and give you information that will take you places in the nation's capital you've never been before, and you'll see things you've never seen before. And you will begin to understand what was to be the destiny of America. And, of course, this takes us into why we went to war with Afghanistan to get Osama bin Laden and then never tried to catch him, and then why we went to war with Saddam Hussein to get the weapons of mass destruction, which weren't there, and why we're going to war with Iran, or at least I believe we're going to war with Iran. You need to have the information in those three DVDs or videos, and again, that's Forbidden Secret, my talk, The Secret Mysteries of America's Beginning, and Riddles in Stone. You can also get my book in book form. It's actually the book came from the talk, but the information is there, and I think you'll find it invaluable, and may will help you better to understand what's taking place. And then let me again recommend this book, Programmed to Kill, which don't order it tonight. I'm going to have to tell the girls the exchange. We will carry it, but I think it's an important book. I think Dave's done a wonderful job putting this together. It's not a nice book to read, but it's an important book to read to understand the true nature of what we are up against, and of course how we can begin to counter that for ourselves and for our families and those we love. Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. I'm sorry, if you want to get in touch with us, our number is 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Those other numbers are the numbers for call-ins. I'm not going to take call-ins for a while. We may towards the end of the next hour. You can also listen to our programs on the Internet at RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com, and you can listen there 5 hours a day. You can actually listen 9 hours a day on my site for the replay. We have a 24-hour feed at my site or on Global Star 4. You type in Global Star and then go to 4, and you can get the 24-hour internet feed from our little network we put together. So please tell others about our program. Understand we truly are involved in a spiritual battle, and then please pray for America, pray for revival, pray for Radio Liberty. For our provision and protection, again, our number 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests. And our guest this evening is David McGowan. His book is Programmed to Kill, The Politics of Serial Murder. And it's a powerful, powerful book. And so, David, somebody had called in, and they were asking if you had any thoughts at all about the Hinckley shooting of Reagan, the fact that Hinckley, who tried to kill President Reagan, was the son of a very close friend of the then Vice President, George Herbert Walker Bush.
Yeah, indeed he was, and that was actually another one of the little stories that I dropped into my second book, along with the Henry Lee story. That was another unreported Bush family secret, so to speak, which is that the Hinckley family were very close with the Bush family. In fact, the brother of John Hinckley, whose name was Scott, maybe Scott Hinckley, I think, was scheduled that very night, the day of the shooting, was scheduled to have dinner with one of the Bush brothers. Was it Neil, I think? I don't know. I'm Neil Marvin. One of the Bush boys was actually scheduled to have dinner with one of the Hinckley boys on the day of the shooting. So yeah, they were very, very close. They traveled in the same circles. You know, George Sr. and John Hinckley Sr. were both wealthy Republican Texas oil men, and there were numerous ties between them. And you know, it can't just be a coincidence that the guy who almost propelled George into the White House, you know, several years earlier than when he actually did make it, just happened to be a close friend of the family. You know, I mean, yet amazingly enough, that entire story was completely buried, and the vast majority of Americans to this day don't know about the connections between the Hinckley family and the Bush family.
And of course, the amazing thing is so many things are buried by the media. that we never hear about. Most people have never heard of the so-called White March over in Belgium that with Mark Detroit. And when it came out about this pedophile network that went up to the various highest echelons of the Belgian government, there were 350,000 Belgians in this little tiny country. I don't think there are more than a few million people in that country. And here 350,000 were out demonstrating against the official corruption and the cover-up that went to the police department and to the highest echelons of the government and right into the very royal family itself. And not a word of this in the American media, or hardly any mention of it anyway.
Yeah, absolutely, and that's what eventually forced the government's hand to at least go through the motions of prosecuting the case. Is just this extreme level of public outrage, like you say, hundreds of thousands of people in this tiny country hit the streets all dressed in white, and I mean for a comparable. Situation here in America, I mean, we'd have to have, you know, what, like 30 million people or something on the streets, you know, in proportion to the population. So, I mean, this was just a massive, massive outpouring of public disgust and just, you know, I mean, just absolute disgust with their government and the political system and the cover-up of all this.
And so they basically had to end it with then putting Mark Detroit in the prison, and then shortly after that he walks out of prison, and then he gets caught again and put back in again. But in fact, everybody wondered how this mass murderer could get out of prison for a while. But lots of strange things happen when you're dealing with the very powerful and evil forces working behind the scenes.
Yeah, it's not uncommon at all. I mean, as outrageous as it seemed to the people of Belgium, and it was outrageous, the same thing happens here all the time, except that there's no public outcry because there's no public awareness. I mean, these stories are so successfully and so thoroughly buried that they just slip right by under the radar.
In fact, I really wasn't aware of that story of Henry Lee Lucas until just recently, and the significance of the fact that he was the one person that George Bush had pardoned. At least not pardoned, but at least he commuted his murder sentence. I suppose he'll spend the rest of his life in prison.
He's now dead, actually. He passed away in prison under some rather bizarre circumstances.
Do you think the fact that he wrote a book and told that he was part of this satanic organized murder effort might have played a part in it?
Could be. It's a very obscure book, though. I mean, it hardly sold any copies. I had a hard time even tracking it down. It's not something that very many people at all have read, I'm sure. It never topped the New York Times bestseller list. That's for
well,
sure.
Of course, there's a book now by the man who was in prison right next to Timothy McVeigh called Secrets Worth Dying For. Most people have never heard Timothy McVeigh's true story of why he did what he did in Oklahoma. But, of course, so often these books are out there, and you only stumble on them by accident. And then, of course, you suddenly begin to put the pieces of the puzzle together, and it's... You come up with an entirely different story you're going to get from listening to Rush Limbaugh, that's for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, there's so many books are published every year. I mean, it's just people, most people I don't think have any idea how many hundreds of thousands of books are actually put out there. And very, very few of them ever end up actually prominently displayed on the shelves of your local bookstore, and even fewer ever make the bestseller list. The vast majority of books that are written are just, you know, almost immediately drift off into oblivion, and the better they are, the less publicity and the less awareness of that book there will be, because nobody's going to give it any
In fact, I had one friend who wrote a book and somebody accidentally shredded 5,000 copies of the book, but it was only an accident.
Of course it was. Of course it was. I mean, if you put out a book that really, really challenges the status quo, you won't even get bad reviews on the book. You won't even have people out there trashing it, because they're at least acknowledge. I would love to get some real, just some horrific reviews.
Hold on, that would be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and I was just talking with Dave about, you know, how books are effectively suppressed in America. And David was saying that he'd love to get some bad reviews on his book, but he doesn't get any reviews on his book. And as I just sort of stumbled across it by accident and asked him to come on. Did you self-publish the book?
Yes, I did, actually, yeah.
There's nothing wrong with that. I'm self-publishing my book at the present time and really getting it out pretty well. But then I have an advantage. I have a radio program, and we're in about our 10th printing.
Yeah.
Well, I think your book is a very important book, and if you don't mind, we will contact you, because I think we should carry your book and help to get the information out.
Yeah, that would be great. Yeah, because, like I say, it's virtually impossible to market a book like that, and it's virtually impossible to get it published other than through self-publishing these days, although I'm kind of a big fan of self-publishing now, because what I really liked about it was the complete creative control. I mean, you have nobody, you know, it's pretty much, you put it out exactly as you want it, for better or worse. So, I mean, basically, I don't have anyone to blame for any mistakes in there but me. But by the same token, you know, everything in there is exactly the way that I intended it to be presented. So
how long has the book been out?
Came out 3 years, I think. It's like 2004, I believe. I think it's been bouncing around for a while. But as somebody once told. Well, somebody once told me, if your book doesn't get any publicity or any marketing, for all intents and purposes, it doesn't even exist, because it's just one title out there among the thousands that are released every year. And you know, if there's no machine behind it, you know, doing promotion and publicity, it's never going to go very far, basically. So. You know, it's very easy. You know, like as I was saying before, I would love to get some negative reviews for my book, because at least they'd be acknowledging that it exists and raising people's awareness that it's out there. But, you know, the strategy that is employed is to just completely ignore it. And if you ignore it, it basically doesn't exist. And, you know, for all intents and purposes, it doesn't. So 99.9% of the people out there will never know that book was ever written or released. And not just my book. I mean, you know, all kinds of books by, you know, writers of various stripes that are put out that never go anywhere.
Well, I think your book is a very important book, and I congratulate you on it. Let's tell some of the other stories. Certainly you get into so many of these program killers, these serial killers, and you think that many of them have this common denominator of having had dissociative personalities, and they were either victims of satanic ritual abuse or government ritual abuse. And, of course, remember a few years ago they had a television program. It was called The Pretender. And it was the story of this little boy who'd been kidnapped from his parents and taken to this center. It was some sort of a government agency, traumatically treated but he developed this tremendous ability to pretend to be anything. And it was one of these things every week why he would be escaping from the people from the center who were out to get him. But even though this was a fictional story, they really have, in my estimation, I've talked to people who have actually been involved in this sort of thing, a ritual part of ritual torture and mistreatment by government agencies to make them into sort of almost like a Manchurian candidate. Have you run into that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I never saw that show, actually. I remember my parents used to love that show. They used to watch it all the time, and they used to always tell me I should watch it, and I never saw it. And until you just described it right now, I never actually knew what it was about. So I'm kind of sorry that I never saw it. But
I used to watch it every week. It was a great film, but I always had this lingering feeling that there was more truth than fiction there.
Yeah, I've read quite a few of the first person accounts. I did not use them as references for the book. As I said before, I tried to stick with mostly mainstream references. One of my goals, kind of in putting together the book, was to see whether a fairly compelling case could be put together by just by drawing on mainstream sources, relatively mainstream sources, sources that aren't going to turn a huge portion of the potential audience off. I've read Kathy O'Brien's book, Transformation of America. I've read Bryce Taylor's Thanks for the Memories. A couple of Kathleen Sullivan's, I can't remember what who, but a few of these books. And, you know, a lot of the information is fascinating, but, you know, even I have, you know, some doubts at times about, you know, some of the stories that these people have spun. And I think that in most cases they're quite sincere, but they're also very confused, and they still haven't really sorted out exactly what happened to them and what's real and what's not. So I sort of deliberately tried to avoid those kind of sources, although I am aware that they're out there.
Well, I mean, the stories are so bizarre. The stories in Dr. Colin Ross's book, he's actually a psychiatrist who works with these people who are victims of either satanic ritual abuse or CIA mind control. And fascinating, fascinating material. Well, let's get into the McMartin story, the McMartin child care story, because that was an incredible story, and of course, all sorts of hung juries on that, and as you point out in your book, I mean, the reason the juries couldn't convict them was because, not because they didn't believe they were guilty of sin, but because the prosecution did such a poor job.
Yeah, the prosecution basically presented the case so poorly that they didn't feel that they could pin specific crimes on specific people, although they did state quite explicitly that they did believe that these kids had been horrendously abused. There was no question in their minds about that, but they, because of the sloppy way, and I believe deliberately sloppy way that the prosecution was presented, they were never able to get the convictions that they wanted on specific counts.
Well, now, of course, didn't one of the people from the McMartin case go to prison? Several of them.
One of the Ray Buckey, I believe, did. The case has just drug on and on and on for years. At the time, they were like the most expensive. I don't know if it's still the case. I don't know. Maybe it was eclipsed by OJ. I don't know, but at one time, it was the most expensive criminal case and the longest running in the history of the country. It just went on and on and on and on and on. And, you know, the newspapers were just spinning it every which way. And I was actually on the other side of the aisle until, like, maybe 10 years ago on the McMartin case. And I was one of the ones who believed very strongly that it was a witch hunt.
In fact, you probably read the Wall Street Journal accounts, which tried to give us that idea.
I read a lot of the, I grew up in Torrance, which is a neighboring city to where was it, Manhattan Beach or Hermosa Beach? Hermosa Beach, I think it was, or Manhattan, one of the two. But anyway, I grew up down in there in the beach cities. And so, you know, I had all the local media coverage of it, and they were spinning it every which way. And I was firmly convinced that it was a witch hunt, and, you know, basically what was being presented by a lot of the media, which was that, you know, the real victims were the McMartins who were being persecuted in this witch hunt, and yada, yada, yada. And my mother, believe it or not, who is far from being a conspiracy theorist and thinks that a lot of my ideas are a little bit out there, she argued with me about it for years, because she was actually a public school teacher until she retired in the Torrance Unified School District, and she taught what at the time were called the special education classes, which were kids with learning difficulties. And most of these kids, they weren't stupid. I mean, they weren't any different in ability from other kids. But what she found time and time again is that they were products of very troubled childhoods. You know, alcoholic parents, absentee parents, drug addict parents, whatnot. You know, very abusive home life. So naturally, you know, teaching those classes in the South Bay some of the McMartin kids eventually trickled into her classes in Torrance, you know, the families that had moved out of Manhattan into neighboring communities and whatnot. She found herself teaching some of these kids, and she kept telling me for years and years that I didn't know what I was talking about, that these kids, even in a classroom full of troubled kids, these kids stood out, and that there absolutely had been something horrific that was done to these kids.
There were about 450 of them. I really didn't realize there were
that many. Yeah, 450 kids eventually came forward to report instances of abuse. And so, anyway, long story short, I eventually came around to my mother's line of thinking and eventually had to apologize to her for arguing with her for all those years, because it turned out that she was right about that. And now I just got to convince her that some of my ideas aren't crazy. But
well, you got to listen to my programs, and, you know, maybe she'll start out thinking we're crazy, but before long they're afraid we're not, is the way it goes.
Yeah, so I was fairly, geographically, I was very close to the McMartin case. Yeah,
and, Chris, what finally convinced you that it was true?
When they
found the tunnels, wasn't
that the tunnel report? That was one of them. And as I started to look into this and saw just how many kids there were and the marked similarities in their stories, and found out that a lot of what had been reported simply wasn't true. There wasn't like this little cabal of sinister therapists that were extracting all of these, you know, stories out of these kids. A lot of them just spontaneously on their own to parents and various others.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest is Dave McGowan. We're talking about the McMartin child school case, and this was 450 children came forward and talked about you know, satanic practices and snuff films and murders and pedophilia and all and sacrifices and, you know, I mean, the most bizarre sorts of things. And Chris, but it all really hinged upon, you know, where somebody planted these ideas in the little children's minds. Was it aggressive therapists who were actually giving them the suggestions and then frightening the children into agreeing? And the children kept talking about the tunnels under the school. And the most amazing thing is nobody ever looked for the tunnels until after the case was closed. So you pick up the story there, Dave.
Yeah, the tunnels was, I mean, that was a big one for me, because, I mean, that's something that's still used to this day. You'll read accounts of the McMartin case, and they'll use that as an example of just how ridiculous the case supposedly was. You know, well, look at these kids, were talking about these tunnels, and there obviously never were any tunnels, but in fact there were, and they were documented by an archaeologist, Stickel or something, I think his name. He had a whole team with him, archaeologist, geologist, photographer, and whatnot, and they went through and documented the existence of these tunnels linking the school to a neighboring property, you know, which was exactly what the kids said, you know, that they, you know, they were asked how they were taken in and out of the school without anyone seeing, and they said, well, you know, we went through tunnels and left through another building, and of course everyone scoffed at that, and all of it, you know, all of it was verified, and that was, you know, one of the main things that brought me around. And then, as I said before, the sheer number of kids that were involved, and the fact that their stories were so consistent. And then the final thing, I guess, was when I started looking into what you spoke about a little bit at the top of the last hour. The False Memory Syndrome Foundation, which was very active in putting out that fire at McMartin and at various other of these preschool cases across the country, and if you look at the roster of that, it's just absolutely filled. Or it was. A lot of them have died, but it was at one time just absolutely filled with CIA psychiatrists, guys who were directly involved in the MK Ultra projects. People like you know, Louis Jolyon West and Martin Orne and you know a few others. Their names were right on the you know prominently displayed as members of the cell. So that was another key, you know, thing is, you know, why would the CIA have such a keen interest in
proving there were false memories? There was just nothing there.
Yeah. So there was a whole sort of series of events that sort of brought me around to a different way of looking at the McMartin case, and then just the whole, you know, just researching the whole area of mind control and realizing, you know, what had gone on. And what the motive could have been, because I mean, one of my you know earliest doubts about the case is, well, why would they cover this up? You know, why would so many high officials be willing to cover up such an abhorrent crime? You know, what did they have to gain from that? And there's your answer. It's all tied into the same occult based mind control.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest is Dave McCowan, and he was just saying that as he looks at the McMartin case, and of course the things that convinced him, you know, there are 450 kids all telling basically the same story, and then a massive program launched at that time called the False Memory Syndrome. Chapters all across America, false memory, ideas being implanted in the minds of the children, and who's coordinating this whole thing? Why, the Central Intelligence Agency. And of course, Dave mentions the names of several agents. The only one I mentioned, I remember, was Jolly West. But Jolly West was a well-known CIA psychiatrist. In fact, he was the same fellow who was visiting a fellow in prison named Timothy McVeigh. And I knew people who knew Timothy. And we're talking to him, and Timothy didn't want to see Jocelyn West. But Jocelyn West, one of the few people who was not only allowed, but forced his way into the prison so he could interview Timothy McVeigh and I suppose give him his instructions. Who knows? Jocelyn West has gone to this great reward. We're not quite sure where Timothy McVeigh is at the present time, but I do know that I had a tape from a woman who witnessed the witnessed the execution, and a fellow used to play this over and over again on his talk show. This woman actually had actually witnessed the execution, and she came on to the radio program and said, "I was there. I didn't know you kept breathing after you were dead." And he would play that over and over again on his talk show, then of course they came out, a SWAT team or a local police team came out, and there was an altercation, and they killed the talk show host. That's what I've had on my program in the past, so I've never played that tape on my program. So I don't know where Timothy McVeigh is today. Under any circumstances, I do know that the talk show host is very dead. And anyway, let's get back to David McGowan. There's so many interesting things. One of the things about the McMartin case I did not know is that the number of people who were trying to bring the truth out, one of the parents died mysteriously, and other people died mysteriously too, didn't they?
Yeah, there was at least three. Yeah, as I said before, if you sniff around the edges of these stories, you'll often find a trail of bodies. That's one of the big clues that there's something being covered up. But yeah, the one of the mothers who was very vocal in the beginning in launching the in getting the whole ball rolling on this, and who was later just viciously slandered in the media and presented as just a nutcase and you know just mentally ill and whatnot. She ended up. I don't remember what they wrote, if they wrote it off as a suicide or what.
Suicide, supposedly. She
ended up dead, yeah. And then there was a cop who was scheduled to testify, who was shot like literally the night before he was supposed to appear in court to testify. And then there was another guy who a lot of the kids had identified as being a drug supplier as a guy that brought drugs to the school.
Was that the Wolfman?
Yeah, the Wolfman. His nickname was the Wolfman. He was being tried on separate charges in a separate case in Torrance, and once the kids, I believe, in seeing the news coverage of this other case, they recognized this guy and linked him to the McMartin case, and next thing you know, he turned up dead before he could stand trial. So there was at least three people who appeared to have been key witnesses, key players in this that turned up dead before they could have their day in court.
And of course, you know, as you begin to see this as a pattern, you begin to realize that this is not all coincidence. Somebody's covering this up, and this had to be covered up at the highest levels of government. And much of the media, you know, has sided with McMartin's, and I mean some of the major conservative, so-called conservative publications, call this a great miscarriage of justice.
Yeah, it's been attacked from all angles, actually. One of the loudest critics of the McMartin prosecutions was actually Alexander Coburn. He used to be with The Nation, and now he has his Counterpunch thing. I don't know if he's still with The Nation, but I mean he's regarded as this sort of ultra-liberal political writer. And he was one of the loudest in condemning. He actually went so far at one point as to say that the kids should be imprisoned for perjury, you know, which that was another thing that kind of tipped me off, that he took that position, that this guy, I mean, because by any standard, the kids were victimized, whether, you know, depending on how you look at it, they were either victimized by the teachers and whatnot at the McMartin School, or they were victimized by these overzealous therapists.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Dave McGowan. And go right ahead, Dave. Pick the story up there.
What I was saying was that, regardless of how you look at the case, the kids were obviously the victims. And these are very young kids. These are preschool kids. You know, I mean, we're talking like 3, 4, 5 years old. And so for somebody in a position of prominence in the media to come out and say, forget about the parents, let's imprison the kids, you know, I mean, that was a very strong clue to me that something wasn't quite right in this story, you know, that somebody would take that aggressive of a position against that prosecution to make a statement like that. That was kind of another red flag that told me maybe there's something more here and I should, you know, dig a little deeper.
Well, anyway, you did a nice job. A very, very good summary of the McMartin School case. But then there have been so many of these. And of course, you actually take a lot of this back to a woman named Helena Petrovna Blavatsky. Now, where does Helena come into this? I would just simply point out that there are groups out here to this very day that try to say there is no such thing as the supernatural. There's a group called the Skeptical Inquirer. And they published a magazine, and all of it's about, oh, there is no supernatural. All these people like Helena Petrovna Blavatsky and all these people who have supernatural powers, they're all frauds. There is no such thing as that. And it's sort of like the FBI division that says there is no satanic crime, or the CIA group that says there is no false memory syndrome. So there's been a lot of efforts to say, oh, Helena Petrovna Blavatsky, she didn't have any supernatural power. She was just a phony medium, used all sorts of sound effects to get those things rattling there when she would have her seances. But I believe that Helena Petrovna Blavatsky did channel her books from a demonic spirit. And I believe that she did form an organization that exists to this very day that is powerful, occult influence on everything transpiring in America today. And as an offshoot of her work, we have the New Age movement. We have many of the occult organizations today which are working in a concerted effort to bring about a one-world government, a one-world religion, destroy Christianity, and, of course, to bring about a one-world leader. They're there. The Lucius Trust is one of them, the new group of world servers, and some of the most powerful people in the world today belong to those organizations.
Well,
I'm going to let Dave McGowan pick up the story, and I was just sort of talking through the rest of that so I could give you free rein at this point for you pick up the story of Helena Petrovna Blavatsky, Dave.
Well, she's basically in sort of the same line of descent. What I tried to do in the book, in one chapter of the book, is just in very broad outline kind of form, is just sort of trace this whole family tree of where these thoughts, where these kind of ideas came from, and who the, what chain they passed through, and she's included in there with the founders of the OTO and Crowley and all these other sort of people. If you look at what she was saying, her writings contained she had a huge influence on Hitler and the Third Reich. They got a lot of their occult ideas from her writings and from
Eliphas Levy.
Yeah, that guy.
So
the book basically just tries to sort of trace this family tree of how all these people were connected and how the ideas passed from one generation to the next through all of these sort of key occult figures over the last century or so.
And I think one of the important things is the relationship between the occult and the intelligence agencies. And that's been around for a long time. I mean, it goes back to Elizabeth in England, and Sidney, it was there in the MI6, and to Aleister Crowley, before the Second World War, and certainly it's been around the CIA since the Second World War. The occult, the intelligence agencies, and these secret societies all sort of interlock, don't they?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, the CIA itself is, in a sense, kind of a secret society that sort of oversees a whole lot of other secret societies. It's kind of a whole network, and a lot of these people are members of more than one, these sort of quote unquote secret societies, including our president, Skull and Bones and God knows what else. All of these groups are sort of interlocked, and at the highest levels they're sort of intermingled, and it's all very, very, very closely interlinked, and it's all, I believe, controlled by our intelligence agencies for the most part.
Well, I think that you're absolutely right, and probably intelligence agencies we don't even know about that. All sorts of black budgets, something like $12 billion disappeared over in Iraq, and nobody has any idea what happened to it. Oh, shucks, $12 billion disappeared. We have no idea what happened to it. Well, you can be sure that somebody knows what's happened to it, and I suspect it's going into these black budgets for the black operations that are going on all throughout the world today.
Oh, undoubtedly, yeah. I mean, yeah, there's no doubt that somewhere, someone up in the chain of command knows where all that money went, but whether we'll ever know, that's another question entirely, but yeah, it's... There are so many black budget, quote unquote black budget operations going on at any given time. The CIA has their hands in so many nefarious activities in so many parts of the world. I mean, their reach extends pretty much everywhere. And even people that like us that devote a considerable portion of our time to researching this stuff can really only scratch the surface of how much you know, how much stuff these people are really up to. So, yeah, they need a lot of money. They need a lot of money to run all of these black ops, and then, you know, they get it through various ways, you know, stealing it. Stealing it and claiming it was lost, you know, running drugs, running guns, you know. They have a lot of ways to raise money, but they always need more because there's just so much, you know, there's just so much going on behind the scenes that we'll never know about.
Well, tell me a little bit. Did you ever look into the JonBenet Ramsey murder? This has always intrigued me. Obviously, somebody's covering up for something. Somebody knows what happened, but... we probably will never find out what happened there.
No, we won't. That's actually is covered in the book. You probably didn't get that part.
I didn't get that far.
It's one of the last chapters, basically. And
what's your take on it?
I kind of drew parallels between that and the Lindbergh kidnapping, which I believe was a completely bogus affair. I believe it. Absolutely, she was murdered within the family, and probably as some type of occult type trappings to it. I believe that there's evidence, some of which is presented in the book, that there was child pornography involved. You know, all the elements that we've been talking about for the last couple hours.
Well, what about the police? Why did the police cover this thing up? Because absolutely, the police had to be, or somebody in the police had to be involved.
Yeah, absolutely. I believe that for the most part, the Boulder police force, was for the most part motivated to actually solve the crime, and they were prohibited from doing so by the FBI and the Denver PD, both of which stepped in and had their hands all over that investigation. And, you know, certain actors in the thing were definitely corrupt and probably complicit. The DA, well, Alex Hunter, I think, that guy, some serious questions raised about him. But, there's no question that there were elements of the police that were actively working to cover this up. And there were actually resignations from the Boulder Police Department. Some of the officers just basically... walked off the job because they were just so disgusted by what they saw happening, with this case. And, you know, I mean, the Ramseys assembled quite a spin team to present their side of the argument, you know. And John Ramsey was a very well-connected guy. He had government connections Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of stuff there that's been grossly misrepresented in the media from day one about the JonBenet Ramsey case.
All right, fine. Well, this to me was an example of, you know, somebody getting away with murder. Who it was, I don't know. But obviously, somebody kept the police from bringing charges. I'm sure that's the case.
Oh, absolutely! Yeah, absolutely. The case was mishandled right from the beginning, from the initial police response and the way that the family was dealt with, and the way that the crime scene was treated and not secured. And I mean, there was all kinds of irregularities, you know, that are detailed in the one of the latter chapters of the book about just, you know, how thoroughly the investigation was compromised almost right from the beginning.
And I have the feeling that this is exactly what happened last Monday. I don't think that this was handled at all correctly. I mean, the police should have been in there as soon as they knew the murderer was, you know, this fellow was there. But nobody witnessed anything. Nobody saw anything. And certainly we know a lot of people got killed, a lot of people got shot, but what really happened, we don't know.
No, we don't, and over time, various investigators will scrape together different details, and we'll get a clearer picture of it. But whether we'll ever know exactly what happened, that's another question entirely. You know, I mean, there's a couple things that have already emerged, you know, that are tantalizing little bits and pieces, like his older sister works for the U.S. State Department. working with defense contractors on the supposed reconstruction of Iraq, which, by the way, the D.C. sniper, John Muhammad, going back to that, we were talking about that earlier, the last big shooting case to occur in that part of the world, his ex-wife worked for the State Department. So, you know, it's kind of odd that both of these high-profile shooters in Virginia in recent years both had an immediate family member that worked for the U.S. State Department. You know, that's a little odd, wouldn't you say? And then, you know, there's the fact that this kid, this Cho kid, the high school that he graduated from, produced another gun-wielding psycho that last year went on a shooting rampage in a police station and killed two police officers. And then he himself was gunned down. And both he and Cho graduated from the same high school. So this high school, in a couple of years' time, which happens to be in a suburb of Washington, D.C., just happened to produce two of these, you know, psychotic spree killers in the space of a couple of years. So, you know, there's already a few little tantalizing details that have come out, and I'm sure much more will, you know, in the coming weeks and months.
Well, then maybe we can look forward to another book from you.
Maybe.
All right, fine. Well, did you ever look into Ed Kemper? Do you have any idea what triggered his killing spree?
I can't even remember what specific crimes he was.
Well, he was the one who first of all killed his grandmother and grandfather. Then they put him into a mental institution, and then they said, "Oh, he's perfectly sane." Then they released him, and because that's when he came to his mother lived in Santa Cruz, and so you know, he started on his killing spree here. Ended up killing his mother and his mother's and the next door neighbor. And then about a dozen girls, co-eds, and would dismember them and throw them in the ocean. And I help but wonder, maybe did they do something to him when he was in the hospital?
Most likely. I don't remember where it was, but I believe, and I may be mistaken about this, because all these cases kind of flow together after a while. But I believe that the facility that he was sent to, which I think it was Patton State, has been linked to mind control. There's a couple of correctional facilities here in California. Vacaville was one, which produced Donald DeFries of the infamous SLA, and Patton State is another one that have been linked numerous times to various MK Ultra, you know, behavior modification programs. And I believe that that's where he was sent following the initial murders, where he basically picked off his grandparents with a rifle or something, didn't he?
I forgot now. The
sniped
details.
Him from a window in the house or some crazy thing. And then he was the big guy, right? The giant guy. He was 6'9" or something. This huge, like, gentle giant.
Right.
And from what I recall, he had a lot of friends on the police force. In fact, he whiled away a lot of his time in a police bar, sitting around, you know, drinking and shooting the breeze with police. He liked to hang out with the police.
You know, the most amazing thing is they never would have caught him if he hadn't actually gone into a telephone booth and confessed what he was doing.
Yeah, didn't he? Like, he left. He drove and, you know, like, crossed state lines, like, all the way to, like, Arizona, New Mexico, or something. And then for some reason, he had packed up his guns or something, and then he just decided to stop and turn himself in.
Because this was the same thing with this Washington shooter who was with Muhammad. I mean, they were calling in and giving the police all sorts of clues. You don't do that when you're murderers. And then you don't simply get into your car, you know, and go to sleep in the car, so all the police have to do is come and knock on the door. That story just was the most incredible story. We've never got the full truth about what that Washington shooter was about, Muhammad and the young boy.
Yeah, absolutely, and we never will. And you don't even hear about it at all anymore. It's amazing how these stories that are so huge when they happen, they just sort of... you know, I mean, there's been so many things that have happened, like post 9/11, that sort of splashed across the headlines for a time, and then they've just as quickly forgotten. I mean, nobody ever talks about, like, the anthrax attacks anymore, you know, or the DC sniper. You know, all of these things that kind of came in the wake of the 911 attacks have just... they've just sort of dropped down the memory hole, and you know, people just, you know, they move, the media moves us along to other stories, and everybody just forgets about it, and it goes away, you know, and we never come close to getting to the truth of it. And the same is undoubtedly going to be true on this Virginia Tech thing, you know, another couple of weeks it'll fade from the news, you know, and we'll never get any real legitimate answers as to what happened that day and how this guy could take a two-hour break and then, you know, supposedly continue his streak, you know, completely unmolested by any sort of police presence, you know. It's just, it's incredible. But it happens over and over again, and we're going to continue to see it happen over and over again.
But each one of these leaves an indelible imprint on the minds of the public. And of course, I really believe that they're playing games with our minds as well as with the minds of these programmed killers, these programmed serial killers.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I should have probably brought that up sooner. But yeah, in addition to, you know, I mean, we've kind of talked about how this, the whole serial killer mythology is used as a cover to deny the existence of occult crime and, you know, to sort of cover up the existence of mind control programs and whatnot. But there is another agenda, there is another purpose to it, and that is to scare the American people, basically, to strike fear into the hearts of the American people. It's all about control through fear, and if you instill enough fear in the people, then they're going to look to Big Brother to protect them. And you know, that's very much a part of this. It's very much a part of the spree killings, the school and workplace killings, and it's very much a part of the serial killer phenomenon.
Oh, I don't think we can look to Big Brother or Big Government to protect us. I think we have to look to the Lord to protect us, because that is our only real protection, the only hope we have. You know, if we fear the Lord and we obey the Lord, we believe that the Lord will look after us. And we hope and pray that we will not go home until the appointed time. Now, it may be sooner, it may be later. Hopefully it'll be later, and I believe that the Lord has looked after me, and I believe he'll look after the people in the audience. If they'll put their faith in him and really, of course, give their lives to him. You can believe in the Lord, but the thing is, are you willing to let him direct what you're doing? If you do, why, I think you can expect his blessing and his protection. Well, our guest this evening has been David McCowan and his book, Programmed to Kill. We will be carrying the book. We think it's important. We think it's important you understand we're involved in a spiritual battle for the souls of men and the survival of Western civilization. We'll be back here in just a moment to wrap up tonight's program at Radio Liberty. Well, Dave, I'm going to give you 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
Okay, where do I go?
I don't know now. That you've written a fascinating book. You got more details in here than you can shake a stick at. So, I mean, we can talk about really anything that you would like to. You know, you talk about Dr. Oda, about Dorothy Cadwalader, wife Virginia. I knew Dr. Oda. Dorothy Cadwalader had worked for me, and they were, of course, killed in another very famous murder here in the Santa Cruz area.
Yeah. Your part of the world is actually, Santa Cruz is actually kind of the birthplace, actually, of sort of the modern serial killer phenomenon. You know, there were people like this around before, but they were very few and far between. You know, you had your Boston Strangler, your Ed Gein, or Jack the Ripper, or whatever. But I mean, it was a very, very rare phenomenon, and it wasn't really until the late '60s and early '70s that this became a permanent part of the American landscape, and that the term itself is, I mean, before the early '70s, we didn't even have a name for these people. They were so rare, and the term was actually coined by the FBI in the early '70s to sort of explain this this phenomenon, this sudden kind of explosion of these people that just sort of began littering the American landscape. And it really began right there in your backyard in the San Francisco, Santa Cruz area in the late 60s and early 70s when that area spawned like a half a dozen of these people. You had Charlie Manson up there running around for a while before he worked his way down to L.A. You had Ed Kemper. You had
the fellow who killed
Mullen, right. What was something, Herb Mullen.
Yeah, that's right.
Had the Zodiac. You had and a couple of the guy, John Lindley Frazier, that knocked off the entire Oda family.
Right.
And there was a sixth one, I think. So, I mean, virtually simultaneously, you had like six of these guys operating in this tiny little geographic area when this was a phenomenon that was so rare that we didn't even have a name for it. And yet, your city was just crawling with these people. And that also happened to be a city that at that time, in the late 60s and early 70s, was just an absolute hotbed of MK Ultra and behavior modification operations. You know, you had the Louis Jolly West was there, for example, who we talked about a little bit earlier, and various other people. So, you know, you had this whole kind of this whole area was
Hold that thought for us right there.
Okay.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Dave was just saying that the area where we live here in the Santa Cruz area, San Francisco area, it was a center for this, and we had, it sort of all started here with the Zodiac, and then the Mullins killing, and the Fraser, and of course the Kemper. They were all right here in our area, and of course, I don't know whether that is, anything to be very proud of, but this is where the serial killing really so much of it became, because the CIA had their operations here, and even, according to Dave, Jolly West was here. Well, Dave, I want to thank you so much for being with us. It's been a real pleasure, and I'll be talking to you off the air, because I really want to get you on our other programs. I want people to begin to see how this all ties together, and I think you've done a great job of it.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you very much for having me.
Okay.
I don't get these opportunities all that often, so yeah. I'm very grateful when they come along.
Well, we'll be glad to give you the full exposure here, at least on our little network. Good night, and God bless you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. And, of course, if you're interested in getting Dave's book, why, you can call us at 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Please don't call until the morning, though, because the girls won't know about it till we call them after the program. And we carry a number of books on this. We actually have the book, The CIA Doctors, going into how the plan program to create these dissociative personalities financed with your tax dollars. We actually have a CD we offer with 18,000 pages of CIA documents readily available on it. These, of course, were declassified by the Church Committee. We have the Church Committee hearings on MKUltra. We have the book Mass Control and Mind Control, written by Jim Keith, who died not too long after he wrote those under very mysterious circumstances. We got a great 4-tape set on mind control. And then, of course, we carry the books by Kathy Phillips and Kathy O'Brien and Mark Phillips. The Transformation of America, that's The Transformation of America, or Access Denied. We carry these books. We want you to have access to the information. Now, David McCowan's book, Program to Kill, excellent. Satanic Crimes by William Kennedy, excellent book. And then The CIA Doctors, Mind Control, Mass Control, CD with the 18,000 pages of CIA documents on it, CIA Doctors, the 4-tape set on mind control, and the books by Mark Phillips and Kathy O'Brien, Access Denied, and, of course, Transformation of America. You need to understand really what we're up against. But to put things into their proper perspective, you need to hear my talk, Brotherhood of Darkness. It's available in DVD, video, and in book form. My latest talk, which I think is very important, Forbidden Secret, will tell you the secret that's been passed down for 5,000 years through the secret societies. And then, of course, new videos by Chris Pinto, The Secret Mysteries of America's Beginning, and Riddles in Stone, The Secret Architecture of Our Nation's Capital. And then, of course, to put them into perhaps more contemporary turns, by the videos by Joe Simmel, who himself at one time was demonically possessed, entitled They Sold Their Souls for Rock and Roll. Joe was a songwriter. He was writing these songs until he realized that he wasn't writing, that they were channeled through him. And it was at that time he got scared to death and realized that he himself was demonically possessed and gave his life to the Lord. He's a minister today. In fact, he's Chris Pinto's minister. And of course, he does a great job there in They Sold Their Souls for Rock and Roll. If you'd like more information on any of this, why, you can always call us at 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Please go to our webpage at RadioLiberty.com, where you can listen to our live radio programming 9 hours a day. And then